Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us for SPIRIT, the stimulating program initiative for retirees that inspires thought. I'm Judy Steinig, Director of Community Programs for the Orthodox Union, and it's my honor to coordinate and host this program. SPIRIT was started a few years ago as an on-site program, and now we're happy to present it in a virtual setting for retirees, not yet retirees, baby boomers, empty nesters, sandwich generation parents, and seniors, all of us who are looking for spiritual, educational, and intellectual stimulation. Now, since, of course, we are all still sheltering in, SPIRIT is the perfect way for everyone to engage in an online setting. Today, we are so fortunate to have as our guest my esteemed colleague, Rabbi Alan Kalinsky, who's the OU West Coast Director, and he serves with me in the Department of Synagogue and Community Services. Rabbi Kalinsky has served the OU for several decades in different settings for as I said, the OU West Coast Director. Also, he serves with OU Kosher, and he's also been a synagogue rabbi. But today we're going to focus on a very unique part of his career, that of serving in the US Air Force. What is the nice Jewish boy doing in the military? It's my honor and privilege to welcome Rabbi Kalinsky to our Spirit Forum. Thank you, Rabbi Kalinsky, for getting up so early, because I know it's 8 o'clock now in LA, and to join us here.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Thank you, Judy, for inviting me to participate. As far as 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm ready for my first siesta, and I've had about three coffees, so I'm ready to go.
I guess that's what it is, having been in the military for so long. You know, you
start out having been a shul rabbi and going to minyan early. That's how it is. But it is really a pleasure to share some experiences that I've had over the years. This presentation is something that came about maybe 20 years ago at a Passover program, when the tour operator asked me, could you talk about the military? And I was kind of frightened. What could I say about my military career? And I sat down and I made some notes, and I came to the realization that there was something, you know, different and unique in our generation for someone who serves in the military. So I thank you for allowing me this opportunity to share this with many people who joined SPIRIT today.
Well, we're very privileged. Before we get to the actual, you know, the questions that I have for you about your career, can you give us a bit of a personal timeline so we can see how the Air Force fit into all the many, many things you've done in your life?
Yeah, it's interesting because I began looking at opportunities as I was a student at Yeshiva University graduating in the class of 1973, I had already projected that I was going to be going for smicha. And one of the tracks in those days for smicha was to either be a pulpit rabbi, an educator, or to go into the chaplaincy. And Yeshiva University had a very long-standing relationship with the military. Many, many rabbis from YU served in the military. Most prominent of them, of course, is Rabbi Herschel Schachter, Olav HaShalom, who was a chaplain in the army. He was there in the liberation with Rabbi Lau as a young boy. Is seen in pictures with him. So Rabbi Israel Miller and Rabbi Avrich and so many others who served in the military. So it was a natural that students would go into the military and they volunteered. And so it's interesting that I looked at my calendar recently and I noticed that for those of you from New York, I actually had my military physical at Fort Hamilton in 1973, long time ago. And so I joined the military in October of 1973, almost at the exact same time that the Yom Kippur War was going on. And I served for a number of years while I was a student, and I can talk about those experiences later. And I rose through the ranks in different experiences, and I served in the military for 28 years, 3 months and 22 days as a reservist, not on active duty, but as a reservist. And when I signed on to join the Air Force, and that's an interesting question because many of the rabbis from YU went into the Army, not the Air Force. And people ask me, why did you join the Air Force? Well, there are two reasons. One was I look better in blue than in green. Little did I know that as time would go on, the Air Force, we would have little green men as well. But what was interesting was that the Army, when you were a student going in rabbinical school, or if you were going to be a priest or a minister, you had to sign a commitment to them that while you were a student, that when you graduate, you would give them a minimum of 3 years of active duty. And I was only 22 at the time, and I couldn't really project, you know, the next 7 to 10 years of time. The Air Force, on the other hand, came out with a program that only required that you gave a reserve commitment of 3 years. So it was a lot easier pill to swallow, and the Vietnam War was still going on. And although I had a 4D deferment because I was at YU, it was still of concern that people could be sent overseas. And the Vietnam War did end in 1975. As you may recall, those pictures of the last groups of Americans who were on top of the U.S. Embassy being taken out by helicopter. But once the Vietnam War ended, we were pretty much in a peacetime situation till the Gulf War of 1990-91. So that's pretty much the history that I served till 2002. In fact, when I joined the military in 1973, I got a piece of paper that said your mandatory retirement date is 7 November 2001. Now here it is, 1973, and they were already projecting that the maximum that one could serve was 28 years. And when 9/11 happened, my retirement and the retirement of military officers and enlisted people all over the world was put on hold. And I ended up staying another 3 months, and I was very much involved with dealing with family separations and those who were going overseas in those first waves after 9/11. And my retirement took place in February of 2002. So that's a little bit of the history timeline.
Going backwards a little bit, when you first joined, just a question, as a nice Jewish boy spending time in yeshiva, did you have to go through the whole basic training thing, and how did that work out?
Well, that was another interesting difference between the Air Force and the Army. The Army really, all those rabbis who went to the Army had to go through that full 12 weeks of basic training and be yelled at by those drill instructors with their funny hats and their batons. In the Air Force, it was a lot easier. In fact, we did some of our training in air-conditioned gyms. But that would explain why the guys in the Army are much more, they're much more fit. But the military really recognized, the Air Force in particular, recognized the service of those who served as rabbis, ministers, or priests. But we did have physical training. We did go through some of that. Most of the training that we had was in Montgomery, Alabama. So you asked the question about from Brooklyn. Growing up in a very, very sheltered Jewish community, going into the military at age 22 really opened my eyes. It was a very broadening experience of the places that I've been and the people that I saw and the experiences that I had. So it was quite amazing.
What happened when you came home and you said to your parents, Mom and Dad, guess what I'm going to do? What was their reaction?
Well, I noticed that my mom is actually watching this, so I have to be careful what I say. But my father, in fact, was a soldier in World War II. He was drafted in 1943 as a young 22-year-old young man. He ended up going overseas. He was not in the first waves at D-Day, but subsequent to that. And I have a picture of him. He passed away a couple of years ago, very proudly in his uniform. So when I mentioned to them that I was doing this to my mother and father, my mother, who also experienced World War II as a young adult, and she happened to have worked at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. My father said, are you crazy? You're volunteering. There's a war going on in Vietnam. He was quite shocked that someone who didn't have to serve would serve. And in fact, he reminded me that before I went to YU, in that period of time from graduating high school till I went to YU, the selective service came out with a numbering system. And I think I had a number about 150. And my parents were concerned in 1969, as the Vietnam War was really getting its its movement in terms of American soldiers that I could have been drafted. So I think every parent is concerned about putting anyone in harm's way, and it doesn't matter whether it's for the U.S. military or someone who's serving in the IDF in terms of the concern that they have for the well-being and the safekeeping of their children.
But I'm sure they were also very, very proud.
Well, I think they were when I retired, finally.
So how did you come, though, so you joined the military knowing that you were going to become a chaplain, and that was already part
that
of the
correct.
Package
yeah,
for
right.
you?
Right. When I signed on as a second lieutenant, and the title was a chaplain candidate. In fact, I had a name tag that said chaplain candidate on it. And I served for a number of years as a candidate while I was going for smicha studies at YU. And I was sent to a number of different bases over those 3 years, from 1973 to 1976. The most striking of all of those was being sent to Athens, Greece, to lead Rosh Hashanah services at the Athenai Air Base. We had a military presence on the grounds of the Athens airport. You know, everyone talked about how unsafe the Athens airport was, but there was military presence on the airport, and I was housed at a hotel that was owned by the military in downtown Athens. And I actually went to the I went right into the Aegean Sea for Erev Rosh Hashanah before blowing shofar. So it was a quite amazing experience. And the Jewish Welfare Board actually sent kosher food in advance for me. So it was an experience that I remember quite fondly.
So I was going to ask you, just beyond Rosh Hashanah, how is it to be Orthodox and in the army? That can't be an easy situation.
You know, I think during the time of the Vietnam War in particular, when so many people were drafted, many Orthodox people were drafted who were doctors and dentists and attorneys. And in many of the bases that I went to during that period of time through the early 70s and mid 70s, and even beyond that, many people who grew up as Orthodox were in the military. Many of them were doctors who trained on the Berry plan, where the government paid for their medical school tuition. And they came in and they served 10 years, perhaps, and they looked at their watch and they said, well, if I serve 10 more years, I'm gonna get a pension. I think I'm gonna continue. But you know, the Air Force was fortunate that many, many of the major bases of the Air Force were in and close to major Jewish centers of population. So many people could have Jewish Orthodox experience, even though if they served in the military. But the military changed dramatically over the last 20 years since 9/11. So if I had to make that differentiation, the uptick and the amount of people being sent into the theater of operation again and again on isolated tours, it's a lot different than it was during the first half of my career from 1973 to 2001. Where we were pretty much, as the Vietnam War wound down, we were in a more peacetime situation. So in a peacetime situation, those rabbis, priests, and ministers who served in the reserves, we were always seen as backfill. We were seen as people who would fill in on installations in the continental United States, while those who were active duty would be sent overseas. But that's all changed. That even today, reservists have been taken to the theater of operation in Iraq and Afghanistan, which turns out now to be the longest war that we've had in history, almost 20 years.
So you told us, you know, you started, you know, very young, you know, right out of YU. So how does that, tell us how that impacted personally. I know she's not coming on, but we know that your lovely wife, Sandy, thanks, Sandy, okay, is right next to you. How did that impact on Shidduchim and dating and getting married?
It's quite interesting. I think in that period of time, there was it was not a secret to anyone who I was dating in 1973, 1974, that this was something that I was, you know, considering doing. In fact, initially, I had even considered the possibility of going active duty. We got married, and I had requested to be sent to San Antonio, Texas, which had an Orthodox synagogue where Rabbi Sheinfeld has still been the Rav there for more than 50 years. San Antonio, there was a day school, there was kosher food available, and you didn't have to live on the base. You could have lived in the Jewish community, and that would have all been fine. But the military had different ideas. They were going to send me to some godforsaken places, and I was lucky that we didn't make that decision.
At what point did you get married?
In 1975.
Uh-huh. And
I left YU in 76, a year later. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So while you were going off to these different places, so where was Sandy?
It's interesting that we actually talked about this yesterday. You know, there were some assignments where it was feasible to go together. The one that stands out, I had to be in San Antonio for 3 months in 1976 before we moved. And I didn't ask any questions. We flew, I had a ticket. I bought a ticket for Sandy, and I showed up at the officers' quarters, and they said, sorry, this is for single officers only, not for married. And I went to see the chaplain, who happened to be a Catholic priest. I said, sir, I have a difficult situation. I'm here with my wife. He said, Rabbi, you came here to be on active duty, not to have a honeymoon. Send your bride back to New York. And it was interesting. There was a senior sergeant who overheard the whole conversation.
How long were you married when that happened?
We were married about 6 months.
6 months.
6 months. And a sergeant was very, very attentive to what was happening, came over to me, says, Rabbi, I will make certain that your wife doesn't have to get on the next plane. And he worked out arrangements off base where we stayed, and the rest is history. And I actually met up with that chaplain many times later throughout my career, and he always reminded me how I had a lot of audacity to bring my bride for a honeymoon to San Antonio.
So tell me, somewhere in here, you also managed to find the time to also be the Rav of a shul. So how did all that work out?
Well,
before you came to the OU, right?
Right, way before. And we'll talk about the OU too in that context as well. When I came to our first community, first congregation, we lived in Maine. And when I had a meet with the president and the officers, I had made it quite clear that being part of the military is something that was very important to me, and that they had to make an accommodation to allow me to do my military duty. And many of the people who were members then in the mid-70s, some of them had actually served in World War II or the Korean War. So they understood, they had a sense of community, they had a sense of patriotism, and they wholeheartedly supported my being part of the military. In fact, it was in that first community where we served, I was assigned to the northernmost base in the United States in northern Maine. It was called Loring Air Force Base, just north of Presque Isle, and Caribou, Maine. That's the name, Caribou, Maine. And it was part of the northern tier. The northern tier of the United States in the 60s and the 70s and even into the 80s was where all the strategic air command bases were, with the big B-52 bombers, fearful of an attack from the Russians. So we had these big lumbering airplanes sitting on the runway 24/7, guarded by sentries and pilots and navigators and bombardiers sitting in an alert facility, just waiting for the alarm to go off to rev their engines and just go off to drop nuclear bombs on Russia. That was the target. So that was the northern tier. In fact, spent a number of years at that base. And it was at that base that I had the most interesting experience, perhaps that overshadowed my whole career, and that is a case regarding my beard. I came on duty and I refused to shave. I had spoken to Nat Lewin, the famous constitutional lawyer, who had won a similar case for a rabbi in previous year or two before. And he told me it's your constitutional right to wear a beard. And I came on duty and I told the chaplain that I wasn't going to shave my beard, because up until that time, I had to shave my beard every time I went on duty. And I had a beard while I was a student at NYU. It was a challenge. And I just refused to do it finally. And the newspaper headlines in 1977 said, the newest enemy of the Air Force is a bearded Orthodox rabbi. And Nat Lewin was fuming about the fact that the government didn't see his first case of handling this for Rabbi Geller, was his name, that it wasn't a precedent. And he had to fight the case all over again in the First District Court of Washington, together with a contemporary of mine, Danny Butler. Rafi Butler's older brother, Danny Butler, was my attorney with Nat Lewin. They fought the case for almost 2 years. It was going on and on and on. They did this pro bono as part of COPA, the Commission on Law and Public Affairs that was running at that time. And finally, in 1979, the military backed down and they changed the regulation regarding personal grooming, that a chaplain on reserve duty for 30 days or less would be permitted to wear a neatly trimmed beard. And every time I would go on, it was a one-page document from the government. I had a document that I carried in my wallet, and I had to pull it out every time someone would see me with my uniform and a yarmulke and a beard, because it was such a shocking thing to see someone out of uniform. And usually it was senior enlisted officers, sergeants, senior master sergeants who had served 20, 30 years, many of them, you know, never seen a Jew before. And all of a sudden, this guy walking around with first lieutenant bars, then captain bars, then a major. And even when I served in my highest rank as a lieutenant colonel, there would always be one person who would come up to me while I would be visiting people at the hospital or at workstations, or even just walking through the BX or commissary, just being on the base in uniform. It was so out of place that they couldn't really accept that. But yeah, that was something that took a while to see it through. And I forever thank Nat Lewin and Danny Butler for taking the time to really fight the case on my behalf.
Fascinating. So how long, so you were in Maine for how long? And then
we were in Maine for about 5 years. So after I won the case, I had to go back to that same base and look at that same group of characters for about a year or so. And I got promoted, which was even more surprising. I think they were a little gun shy at the military, because I don't think they wanted to deal with Nat Lewin a second time around. And I got promoted. But I really got promoted because I performed my duties as was required, and did bring a sense of Jewish programming to the outer northernmost base that we had with a handful of Jews that felt completely isolated. And
So after Maine, were you in any other shuls?
Yeah, so then after we lived in Maine for 5 years, then we moved to upstate New York. And I served in another base called Griffiths Air Force Base, and it's in a city that is halfway between Albany and Buffalo, and close to Syracuse. It's a city called Rome, New York. It's amazing how when you drive upstate New York on Route 17, you see all these crazy signs of all these little places. I remember there was a place called Goshen, New York. Yeah. Well, there was a place called Rome, New York. Rome, New York is an actual city. It's right past Utica, New York. Right. And Rome, New York had a base called Griffiths Air Force Base. It was also Strategic Air Command. And I served there for 5 years, made a lot of good friends, and was able to, in that community as well, provide for the spiritual and religious and educational needs of a small Jewish community on the base.
By the way, you should know that one of our spirit partners actually is the Orthodox Shul in Utica, New York. So we may have some of those people on today also. So still alive, still doing well. So then how long till you got to LA?
So that was another 5 years. So I served in Rabbanus for 10 years with my wife. And then we made a decision that we really wanted to come to a major metropolitan area. I had interviewed a number of times at the OU for different positions that were being considered in the early 1980s. And it was our good fortune that the position here in Los Angeles became available through the yeoman efforts of Marty Nachumson, who still continues to be a very important person in the OU, a member of the executive committee, the immediate past national president of the OU as well. And when I met with the committee of people in 1985, I had already had 10 good years in the reserves, which is halfway towards retirement, because you just need to serve 20 years. And I made it clear to Marty and to Professor Questel. Shimmy Questel was president of the OU at the time. And he was a little challenging, Shimmy Questel, in terms of, you know, how are you going to do 30 days a year of military service while you're doing your job at the OU? I said, just wait and see. And it turned out that many times I went on military duty to communities where we had OU synagogues. So I was doing double duty, whether I went to Las Vegas or I went to Seattle or other places up and down, or Denver. So many times I would go on duty and I was able to do both effectively. And one of the interesting things that developed, and I think hats off to the military in that regard, the military recognized how vital having people in the reserves being trained. And they came out with a program, and it still exists today. I actually called someone to ask about it. It's called Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve. And every year that I continued to serve, I would get a certificate from the military that I would present to the national president of the OU to recognize the OU's commitment to allowing me to serve in the military. And it was a recognition. And I remember several of the national presidents who received these awards, these beautifully certificates that was suitable for framing and hanging. Even Questel, Professor Questel, and Shelley Rudolph, Oliver Shalom, and others, and Dr. Gantrell, who actually served as a surgeon during the Vietnam War, and Harvey Blitz, and others. It was a recognition that they were doing the right thing, giving me the time off to serve in the military as well.
Okay. Can you share with us special memories of all these years of, you know, things that happened that you thought were really significant?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things that one can pull out of memory, different places that I served and certain things that happened there. I'll talk about that in three levels. I'll talk about things that I did in Los Angeles. It turns out that when we came to Los Angeles in January 1986, I was thrilled to come to LA for a variety of reasons, but knowing that there were several Air Force bases in and around Los Angeles, within an hour drive of Los Angeles. But to my great dismay, each of the bases had rabbis attached to them. And there was only one place that I didn't know about. It was called at that time Los Angeles Air Force Station. It was a little military installation 1 mile south of LAX, in the city of El Segundo. It was an Air Force station. It was so small, it did not have a runway of its own. It was simply a very high tech. It was part of space and missile systems. And I actually went to see the chaplain at that base when we came here. And I introduced myself, I met with him, and he said, Rabbi, this base never had a rabbi, will never have a rabbi. And if you ever did come here, you would never succeed. And I went home very dejected, because here I am in the major place and there's no military installation that has an opportunity for me to continue my service that would be effective. And it turned out that LA Air Force Station at that time was part of a a command called Systems Command. And in the previous assignment that I had in upstate New York, the chaplain there was now in charge of Systems Command. And I actually called up my old friend Clay Kennedy and I told him what was happening. And he said, Alan, give me 24 hours, you'll be assigned to LA Air Force Station. Next day I got a phone call from the chaplain at the base and he said, Rabbi, when would you like to begin? You know, here's a guy who said, nothing doing. And it turned out that I spent the majority of my career living in Los Angeles, serving at LA Air Force Station, which became LA Air Force Base. So it really was, it was easy to work for the OU and have my military assignment less than 10 miles away from my home, which enabled me to do double duty with ease. And at LA Air Force Base, I was able to do many amazing things just because of the community. I was able to institute a full range of programming. I showed you, Judy, before that I actually wanted to put up a sukkah, and we didn't have a budget for sukkahs, so somebody ended up some engineers came up with an idea of making a sukkah out of parachutes. So very they framed creative. A building and then put parachutes as the walls of the sukkah. We would have many holiday celebrations, and my good friend, Dr. Mark Goldenberg, who's a raconteur, he's an entertainer, would come with his guitar. He would entertain at Hanukkah parties, at Purim parties. And he was very instrumental, no pun intended, Mark, because I know he's listening, in the training of Jewish lay leaders. One of the things that happened as we found ourselves in a peacetime situation through the 1980s and into the 1990s, there were less rabbis in the military, and especially in the Air Force. And there was a need to train Jewish lay leaders. And the National Jewish Welfare Board at the time recognized that, and they started working on this program together with Rabbi Dr. Chaplain Victor Solomon, Olav HaSolom. Vic Solomon used to live in Teaneck. He was a psychologist, he was an amazing man. He started those training sessions and handed it over to me. And for three consecutive cycles, we had Jewish lay leader conferences during the month of July in the 1990s, 91, 93, 95, 97, I believe, in LA, where 15 Jewish lay leaders from across the military were authorized, were given a travel allowance to come to Los Angeles. And for 3-4 days, we trained them. And part of the training was in a classroom setting. Part of it was in the community. We brought people to meet a sofer. We took them to the Simon Wiesenthal Center, and Rabbi Heyer and Rabbi Cooper were very helpful in welcoming them and teaching them about the Shoah and its message to the military, and going to kosher restaurants. And many people continue to have that relationship. So I was actually given a certificate of merit in recognition of the training that we did for those people over the course of that time, and it was quite important. In addition to that, here in LA, we had access to many amazing speakers. For Yom HaShoah, Rabbi Heyer came to speak, Dennis Prager came to speak, Robert Clary, if you remember the TV show, Hogan's Heroes, Robert Clary was a little Frenchman, right. He lived in LA, I think he's still alive. He was a speaker for the Wiesenthal Center. And he came and told his stories. And perhaps the most, besides Rabbi Heyer, was our relationship through the OU with those who have served as the Council General of Israel for Los Angeles. Over my 35 years, I've met many amazing Israeli diplomats who've served in Los Angeles. But there was one gentleman who came to serve in the 1980s. His name was Ron Ronen. Who was Ron Ronen? He was a one-star brigadier general in the Israeli Air Force who shot down Syrian MiGs in the 1973, the Yom Kippur War. And that part of his bio was not really posted, but I found out about it and I said it would be an amazing thing if you would come to LA Air Force Base. We had to go through a lot of hoops because of the diplomatic things. But when it was announced that a one-star general was coming to an American Air Force base to talk about the situation in the Middle East, All the generals perked up, all of the senior officers. They thought that this was, they were anxious to take pictures with an Israeli ace. Because when you look at the military, you know, people have this misunderstanding. They think everybody who's in the Air Force is a pilot. That's a misnomer. The number of pilots that we have is most probably less than 10% of all the people in the Air Force. Majority of people are doing support work so that the pilots can do their job. So when they were intrigued to take a picture with someone who shot down two MiGs, because most of them were pencil pushers. They could have been a three-star general at the time. He had flown, but he never shot down an enemy plane before. So it was quite amazing to have him. And then there was one thing which we know about, you may have read about it, that every year in Washington, D.C., there was a program called the National Prayer Breakfast. It's held by Congress, and they usually have these amazing speakers to address them. I believe Rabbi Heyer actually did it a few years ago because of his closeness to President Trump. So I was given the task by the chaplain at the base. He said, Rabbi, you do so many good things. How about doing something beyond the Jewish community? You have access that's unbelievable. He said, I want you to be in charge of the National Prayer Breakfast here at LA Air Force Base. We can expect a couple of hundred people. He said, find somebody to be the speaker. And I didn't know what to do. Who am I going to get to speak who's going to breathe fire and brimstone? Because they're used to having ministers, you know, get up there and really scorch the people. And Sandy and I said, who are we going to bring? And she said, there's only one person you can bring. And that's Rabbi Benjamin Blech, our good friend, Rabbi Blech. Blech had just been on the Oprah Winfrey show. So when I told everybody that here is a rabbi who has this national acclaim, they were really excited. They posted it that way. They promoted it that way. Rabbi Blech came with Elaine for a few days in L.A. as guest of the United States government. And he got up there that morning. They were all eating their bacon and eggs. And he gets up there, and he was on fire. He was amazing. And as he finishes, the chaplain gets up. He has a nice plaque to present to him. And he says, I never knew rabbis can speak better than Southern Baptist preachers. And Rabbi Blech was so tickled that he was given that same nomenclature.
Wow. Oh, wow. That's amazing. In your work everywhere, do you feel that you were able to be Makariv, you know, Jewish soldiers and anybody from being involved?
It's interesting. Right. It's interesting that, you know, I think when we started out in the 70s, I don't think anybody saw this as a cure of opportunity. Today, over the last 20 years since the Gulf War, the number of rabbis going into the military has changed dramatically. Many Chabad rabbis, those who have been trained through Chabad, have gone into the military, and their sole raison d'etre is Kiruv. We were successful with a number of people who I was involved with personally, but you have to remember that I was only a part-time person. I was not somebody that was on the base every day, every week, every Shabbat. So my contact, the way my service ran was I had to give one day a month. So I picked a certain day every month, and then 2 weeks in the summer usually that I would be on duty. And then there would be, I know, special assignments. Sandy reminded me of an amazing assignment that I had to Alaska. The first time I went to Alaska, I got a phone call. Yeah, no, it's interesting. It ended up in the winter, but I got a phone call from a sergeant in Fairbanks, Alaska. You can't get much further than Fairbanks, Alaska. It's hours past Anchorage, Alaska, which has a Jewish community today. And this sergeant called me up and said, you're the closest rabbi to us, and we have a family who wants to have a bat mitzvah for their daughter. And can you arrange to come up during July? This was in May sometime. This is in the late 1990s. And I agreed to make the commitment to go up to Alaska. I fly up there on Alaska Airlines. I get there after hours and hours of traveling. And I forgot that it never gets dark in Alaska. And I want to get some sleep.
In the summer.
And it was in summertime. And I'm dozing off, and I get a knock on the door. It's this sergeant who I was talking to. And she walks in. She's a woman with a Southern accent. And she walks in with her 11 and a half year old daughter, who is black with those corn. And she said, I'm Jewish. My daughter is Jewish. I want to have a bat mitzvah for her. And I began a program of study with her for 6 months after I left. And when people found out that I was coming back in November, it turned out there was a young boy who was also scheduled for bar mitzvah. So we had the first bar and bat mitzvah in Fairbanks, Alaska on a Shabbos. There's a small synagogue in Fairbanks, but it was 60 below zero in November. And Shabbos came in at about 2 o'clock.
And you came from L.A. to go there.
There for three, four days and came to Alaska. It was about 60 below zero, and there was nothing to keep you warm, pretty much. But my uniforms got lost on the plane traveling up. So it was an experience.
Got it. Okay, well, we have a few minutes left. Let me just ask you, looking back on your service for so many years, what would you advise if a young smicha student came to you now and said they were interested in doing this? What would you advise them?
Well, I think that, you know, over the course of time, I think that everyone who has served recognizes that there's a need, and that if you can influence people to continue that tradition. In fact, when I was a student, there was actually a class in the supplementary rabbinics program that happened on a Friday morning, and went on for like 16 Fridays from October till January. And the seminar itself, the rabbi who was in charge of the seminar was none other than Rabbi Dr. Israel Miller, who was Olav Shalom, who was a senior person in the YU administration. He too served in World War II. And every Friday, without fail, he would have a guest speaker that would come, many in uniform, who would talk about the chaplaincy. So there were about 25 of us in that class. And it was very impactful that we heard these stories from different rabbis who had served in the Army, in the Air Force, the Navy. There were many rabbis in the Navy who had served as well. And I think a number of young men in my age group in particular, who served, who went in active duty in the 1900s, many of them who were in my smicha class went in to serve, and some who served for many, many years, some who have retired. And it's interesting, you talk about getting the next generation. There's a young man, not so young anymore, but there's a young man named David Becker. He used to work for NCSY. His wife still works for NCSY. And a number of years ago, David came to me and said, tell me more about the chaplaincy. I'm really interested. And I said, David, you're crazy. No, I really want to do it. I really have a calling to do it. David Becker today has, I think, served more than 5 years in the Army. He was promoted to captain. And 3 years ago at our banquet, we honored him and Devorah. And at the banquet, they pinned on his captain bars. We had an amazing ceremony at the OU West Coast banquet. And David Becker is a shining example of someone who is committed to serve our people, to serve our country. He's been to he's been to Afghanistan and Iraq a number of times. He is in the California Army National Guard. And he is a shining example of someone who's dedicated himself. He's actually had a number of conferences here in LA where he's brought different rabbis and chaplains together, and I've actually spoken for them. And I think the key is in any situation where you are involved in something that you have a passion about, you want to share that with the next generation. Hopefully through your example as a role model, you can inspire someone to take on the mantle of responsibility and leadership.
So to sum up, if you had to do it again, is this the way you would do it?
It's an interesting question that I've posed to myself many years ago. And I would say that, you know, Sandy is sitting next to me now. I think she would agree that it was a very broadening experience. It took the boy from Brooklyn and brought him out into the greater world to see what reality is all about. I think my involvement in the military helped me in my Rabbanus. And I think that that the OU as an organization benefited. And I'm not saying that just to pat myself on the back. I think it benefited too, knowing that there was someone on its staff of over 1,000 people who was a committed person, who was a patriot, who put on the uniform proudly as a weekend warrior, as the term goes, and that that acknowledgement is a significant one. And I believe that, you know, looking back at a career that started when I was age 22, and I was forced to retire. I tried every which way in 2001, after the night, and into early 2002, to reach my congressman and senator to get them to allow me to stay on another 2 or 3 or 4 years. I was exactly 50 years old when I was pretty much forced to retire. I think it's a young age to retire. There's so much that one could have still accomplished. And I was fortunate that at Los Angeles Air Force Base, where I did serve, and I proved that there was a need to have a rabbi, the military did continue having a rabbi on that base for a number of years, till that person was sent overseas. And currently, at Los Angeles Air Force Base, there are Jewish lay leaders who carry on the responsibility, and there's a Chabad rabbi from South Bay who has been coming on to teach and to inspire the people on the base. So it's been a rewarding career, and now I reap the benefits. I can wear a shirt that says I'm retired, and we can. It's amazing. Every place I go, I wear my baseball hat that says the Air Force, and barely a time goes by where someone comes up to me, either young or old, and says, "Thank you for your service." Beautiful. And I think that's it makes you feel good to know that someone appreciated what you did on behalf of our country.
Well, they certainly should be appreciated. Any final comments that you have? Anything you want to share with us?
No, Sandy, I think we touched upon a lot of different things. I think Sandy has a few words. She'd like to be the closing.
Okay. No, I don't want to be the closing. I think Alan did a really good job in explaining and expressing himself beautifully, and I hope you all enjoyed the presentation. It's true that it did impact our lives, but I think it impacted our lives in a very positive way. We were exposed to many people whom we never would have met otherwise. People of all denominations, and it was really wonderful to see how accepted we were when we did go to the Air Force Base, how respected Alan was as a chaplain. And he didn't, I don't know if it came out in this conversation, but being a chaplain in the United States Air Force, a Jewish chaplain, does not mean that you only work with Jewish people. He was able to, he consulted to all denominations. That's part of the job. I don't know if people realize that. It's not just dealing with Jewish personnel, is dealing with all personnel. And it just, I think, enriched our lives a lot. And I'm glad he didn't decide to go active duty, though. I am happy about that. And thank you so much for affording him this opportunity. He really served proudly, and I was very proud of him.
Thank you.
We want to thank both of you, both Rabbi Alan and Sandy Klinsky. I would love to think that I'm going to be back in LA soon, but we'll wait and see how long the next time is with COVID. But it's wonderful to see you guys both on screen. We want to thank everybody for joining us today. As I tell you all the time, you don't have to ask me for the recording of this session because I know everyone's going to want it. And anybody who, Rabbi Klinsky, tell all of your friends in LA that couldn't get up on time, but as long as they registered, with God's help, later this afternoon, they will all have the recording. As soon as we get it, we send it out to everyone who registers. And Terrific. Now, very exciting news we have is that it won't be in the archives yet, hopefully in another week or so, but we do have archives of all of our Spirit programs up until last week. And in the email that I will send out this afternoon, we will have that link. I sent it out the other day, and it was exciting to see how many people, because you actually have to sign up to have the access. And then once you have it, you can download anything you want. And those recordings will be there, I've been told, forever. So everybody just stay tuned and look for your emails, because it will be at the bottom of it. So let me just share with you, next week on Tuesday, we will be having another one of our relocation programs. This one is the part of a two-part program dealing with Aliyah. And we're very fortunate to have Nefesh B'Nefesh, who are certainly the experts in the field who will be presenting to us. And on Thursday, we'll be dealing with health issues and how to improve our health and immunity with vitamins and minerals. So thank you so much again for joining us. Watch your emails for registration for next week. And the email with the recording will come out from my email, Judy Steinig. So if you have registered, you will have received it unless it went to your spam. So have a great day. Have a good Shabbos. Be safe and be healthy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Judy.
Bye-bye.